Okay, so this is the fourth week of our four-part series, and this is the week where we have the real payoff. The goal of this whole mini-series has been to lay the background to introduce David HaMelech, who's such an endlessly fascinating character, and Amir Hashem, going forward, we'll delve into him in depth in the coming weeks. But the goal here was to lay the groundwork. And so the first week, we just looked at the challenges of I don't see a link to the source sheet in the chat. It should be there. I'll send it again while I talk. We looked at the challenge of what it means to be a Jewish king, the inherent problem of, on the one hand, needing that strong hand of leadership, but on the other hand, the corruption that inevitably comes with it. We looked at that in depth in week one. Week two, we got a sense of the actual challenges that Shaul and then David are facing. We saw the map. We understand the enemies all around, ideological enemies like the Plit, like Amalek, powerful military enemies like the Plishtim and Aram in the north. So this is not a job for the faint of heart. This is a job that needs seriously strong-willed people. And last week, we tried to blitz Shaul in 45 minutes, and we saw the tragedy of Shaul is that on the one hand, he transforms. The Navi literally says, Vayafoch le'ish acher. He has to transform into a new person to take on the job that's given to him. It's a job that requires immense willpower to be able to impose his will on a nation, unify the nation, push back all the enemies Klal Yisrael has. And the tragedy is that Shaul is able to do that, but when he transforms into a leader, that ultimately forces him to lose his inner self. And the inner goodness of Shaul goes astray. We saw Shaul repeatedly mistaking his own desire for Hashem's desire. And that was most sharply exemplified when some people come to him in Parak Chav Gimel of Shmuel Aleph, and they say, great news, we know where David is hiding. And he says, Bruchim Atem Lashem, Baruch Hashem, Hashem wanted this to happen. You found David, and I'm going to catch him now, right? Spoiler alert, it's not what Hashem wants. But Shaul repeatedly cannot understand that what he wants and what Hashem wants are two different things. And Chazal asks, what is the difference between Shaul and David, the Gemara and Yuma? And the Gemara said about Shaul counterintuitively, but very, very powerfully, that you can't have a leader who is perfect, right? The problem was, the Gemara said, Ein lo shum dofi. He came in with no flaws. There were no skeletons in his closet. And why is that such a problem? Well, a way to think of it is that he had no skeletons in his closet means he had no immune system to when he makes mistakes. When you're a regular, common or a regular person, people will call you out on your mistakes, right? You'll call yourself out on your mistakes. When someone is king and he's surrounded by yes men and he has immense pressure to lead the nation, and it is so easy, he has so much power, and it's so easy to rationalize every decision he makes. I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for the good of the people. Unless he has that built-in, system where he can correct course and say, wait a second. Am I actually doing this for me? Is this actually the Ratzon HaBore, or is it the Ratzon of Shaul? Shaul just does not have that ability, and it comes up again and again. So now, finally, we can turn and start to look at David HaMelech. And we're gonna see from the get-go David's complexity, which is going to cause a lot of problems, but also ultimately the source of his success. So let's load up screen. Here we go. I want to begin with a medrash which isn't directly about David, or at least so it seems. It's a Gemara in Shabbos. It's also a Gemara in Bava Basra, where it says, Tanu Rabbanan, Arba Mesu B'Ityo Shel Nachash. Right? There were four people who only died because of the advice of the serpents to Adam and Chav. Not for the fact that mortality was decreed on every person, they never would have died. Meaning, they never sin. Four people never sin. Be'eluhin, Binyamin ben Yaakov, okay, so it's Binyamin, Amram, the father of Moshe, Yishai, the father of David, and Kilav, David's son. That's David's second son. Okay, so these four people, the Gemara says, never sinned. Interesting, and the Gemara goes on to prove that each of these four didn't sin. The question, though, is what are we supposed to get? What is the point of this Medrash Chazal about these four people who didn't sin? And if you think about it, the Medrash actually seems to be telling us something not about these four people, but about the people who they're close to. Because all four, Binyamin, Amram, Yishai, and Kelav, to be honest, we do not actually see do very much in the Tanakh. And Binyamin he's a pawn between Yosef and Yehuda, and Amram is just known as Moshe's father, and we don't really see Yishai or Kelav do anything. You know, many of David's sons are going to play an active role in Shmuel Bat, but Kelav, like, totally disappears. So you have four people who never actually really accomplish much of anything, closely associated with people who accomplish an awful lot and whose failures are extremely prominent, right? Binyamin is going to be caught in between Yosef and Yehuda, the two brothers who actually are the leaders of the Shvatim and are actually the ones who are going to carry the next generation transitioning from the world of Yaakov Avinu. And both of them, their failures from the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev are going to be on full display with Yosef Lashon Hara and Yehuda with Tamar and Yehuda selling Yosef into slavery. Same thing with Amram. Amram does not do very much, but all three of his children do, and the Chumash does not shy away from the mistakes that any of them make. Miriam with the Lashon Hara, Aaron at Cheda Egel, and Moshe. The Chumash comes again and again. We never really quite understand what Moshe did at Meriva, but the Chumash keeps coming back to Moshe's mistake with the water. And then both Yishai and Kilav, the father and the son of David, it's so interesting, the Gemara feels a need to like highlight David more than the other ones. David's father doesn't sin and doesn't accomplish anything. David's son doesn't sin and doesn't accomplish anything. And David HaMelech is smack in the middle of the two. And what the Medrash here is pointing us to is that you cannot be in the world. You will not be in a position of leadership where you are actually leading the people and getting things done. Inevitably, there's going to be sin. There's going to be mistake on the way. We live in a flawed world. We do not live in a perfect world. And if someone is going to be perfect, it's very inspiring, but it means that to a large degree, they're not living in this world. And so that's the first piece to have in mind with David HaMelech. Someone's going to be leading, that means that at some point there are going to be mistakes. The question is, how do we keep this under control? We've seen from day one, the corruptive power of the Malchus. This is a necessary institution for Klal Yisrael at the time, but it destroys Shaul. So we know that if someone's going to take the job, there are going to be bumps along the road. But how can we keep those bumps from turning into craters? How can David avoid becoming Shaul, even though the very job he's signing up for means he's never going to be a Yishai, he's never going to be a killer? That is the core, the dilemma of David. And the Navi really gives us the answer. We'll flesh it out, but the core of the answer is going to come from the minute that the Navi introduces us to David. This is actually Parshas Toldos. It's like the perfect week for this year. So we'll see why. So Shmuel in Parak Tez Zion. So after all this, he goes through all the sons. None of them are eligible. So he asks who else is there. And Yishai says, I got one more kid. And the Pasuk says about David, Behu Admoni. He was red. And Yifei Einayim V'tov Ro'i. And he had nice eyes and he was good to, you know, he looked nice. Now, Parshas Toldos, it's a perfect week. We hear the word Admoni. Someone is described as red. Right away, it makes us think about Esav. So the Malbim flags that. We'll see Chazal will flag it as well. The Malbim says this is an essential point. The Malbim writes about this. We have to look at this inside. It says, Shmuel is alarmed, right? Shmuel does not want to anoint this guy as king. Hashem has to basically drag him kicking and screaming. So the Malbim explains, David Haya Admoni. He was red. Shegavro boho aduma. The redness in him was overpowering. V'hu betiv o muchan l'shvichas dam. his inner nature was disposed towards murder. Umitzar acher, at the same time, nirabo gamkein roshmim tovim. He saw that there were positive features in David's account. Ki haya yefei einayim etovrui. On the one hand, he's bright red. It screams Esav. On the other hand, he's got very nice and soft and pleasant eyes, and he looks like a very sweet kid. So there's this alarming combination of the good and the bad, the frightening and the sweet in David. And Shmuel is alarmed about this. Shmuel says, you know, if it was just up to him, this is too risky as someone to put in power as king. I mean, Shaul is being fired because the Malchus corrupted him. Now I see a guy, he's like, you know, it's like Two-Face and Batman, and I see the side of evil. Are we going to go in this direction? And that is why Hashem has to speak up. And Hashem says, right, he sees the heart. He doesn't see the outside. He sees the inside. Hashem yirad leva v'yeda. David has the choice, right? Free will. He has his inner nature. But the question is, what is he going to do with the inner dispositions that Hashem has given him? And he's going to focus on mishpatut tzedakah and focus on justice. What about the violent tendency he has? The redness that was in him. He's going to use the redness in his nature to fight and to kill, but not to kill innocent people, but to fight the wars of Hashem and to cut off anyone who's attacking Klal Yisrael. In other words, when we think of it, is David is going to take the Esav properties that he does have in his personality, and he is going to channel them in the necessary direction for Amalek. He's going to combine being Yaakov with being Esav. And this is what we're going to show in the next few minutes. Go through a number of cases in the Sefer Shmuel where we see the Yaakov piece coming out and the Esav piece coming out. But there's a reason why, in Sefer Parsha, Yitzchak wants to give Esav the bracha, because there is potential there. You have a man of charisma. You have a man of action. You have a man who's bold and energetic. Those all can be leadership qualities. The challenge is going to be to keep them under control, to keep them channeled, right? To keep them directed where they're supposed to be, so that he's using the anger, the energy, the power that comes from the Esav side of him in the right direction, fighting Mochamos Hashem, and not going off and doing, you know, whatever it is that he wants to do. So Chazal point this out explicitly as well. Medrash says, Parshas Toldos, Shmuel sees David, he's Admoni. The Medrash says, Nisyari, he panicked. Amar af zesh shofech tamim, I have a murderer. I'm going to make him a king? The Medrash says, no. Amar lekash baruch hu im yifei inayim. There's a blend. There are the soft eyes. There's the Yaakov piece. Esav mi daito horig. Esav will follow his own desire. Bolzami das sanhedrin horig. David is going to follow the desire of those who are above him. He will accept limits on his own power, right? And we're going to look at this in detail as well. That unlike Shaul, David is going to recognize that his will is not the controlling will. Okay, so it's literally off the bat. When the Navi introduces us to David, right away we are thinking of, we see someone who's half Yaakov, half Esav, and how are those two going to mix? Okay. So just to show how then in the coming pieces of David's career, the Yaakov piece comes out. So we can identify really three different stories where it comes out very clearly. Even in general, Yaakov and David are both going to be the prominent exiles, right? People who are on the run, the fugitives in Tanakh. Later on in Shmuel Beis, David will join Yaakov in having troubles from his sons who do not get along with each other. But their careers and their personalities. So Perek Yilches, it's the Perek right after David defeats Goliath, and now he's the general of Shaul's army. And he's been promised as a reward for killing Goliath. The deal was that he is supposed to marry the king's daughter. So we know that David is going to marry Michal. But Michal is the younger daughter. And originally, son who David was supposed to marry. Originally, Pasuk Yud Zayin, Shaul says to David, "Vayomer Shaul David, Inevi Tiha Gdola Meirav Osa Atein Lachala Isha." Right, he says, "You're going to marry my daughter Meirav, but you have to put in some time. You have to do some work. You know, it doesn't becoming my son-in-law doesn't come free. You have to do a job for me." Now, you know, Shaul is the Navi makes clear Shaul's goal is for David to get killed, right? But originally, Yaakov is supposed to work and marry one daughter. What happens? A couple of seconds later, Shaul pulls the old swapperoo, right? He gives Meirav in marriage to someone else, and then David ends up marrying the other daughter, ends up marrying Michal. But he's going to have to go to work some more, right? You know, the deal was fight the Plishtim and you'll marry Meirav. Never mind, we're going to swap it to Michal. But David is told you have to do some more work. Where is it? Pasuk Chafhei, Shaul says, Kotzim LeDavid, Ein Chivetz HaMelech B'Mohar, I don't want a dowry. Ki B'Meya Arlos Plishtim, Hinakim B'Aveh HaMelech. You have to kill 100 Plishtim and bring 100 foreskins, because the Jews always like to highlight the fact that the Plishtim were Arelim. So you have to go kill 100 Plishtim. So you got to do more work to marry daughter number two, right? And it's not the greatest leap in the world to see, okay, right, who are we supposed to be reminded of over here? It's Yaakov and Lavan, right? And Lavan's two daughters, where Yaakov has to work for one and then has to work for the other, and the father-in-law is swapping. You know, they're not literally the same story, that they're not actually the same story, but the Navi clearly is, you know, reminding us, you know, Lavan and Yaakov, you should be thinking when you're thinking of David and of Shaul. That's a tough look for Shaul. It's a good look for David, right? And this theme continues. One parak later, when things are going downhill and Shaul wants David dead. So this is the parak where Michal helps David escape. So a few things. You have the son-in-law who's running away from the father-in-law, which we're going to have at the end of Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov is going to run away from Lavan. And there are a few pieces which also recall that story as well. Michal, the Navi tells us a couple of times, takes trafim. Now, we don't really know what trafim are, right? Statues or whatever, right? Lavan's trafim, some idol or some instrument of divining the future. Here, the trafim sound like some statue of some sort, because Michal is going to disguise the trafim as David. But there's no way that it's a coincidence that the other time that we have the word trafim show up in Tanakh is, number one, when Yaakov is running away from Lavan and Rachel takes them. And now here, where David is running away from Shaul and Michal is taking trafim. Furthermore, we even have Shaul using a line from Yaakov and Lavan story, "Lama kacha rimisani," which is that's a protest of Yaakov to Lavan. And hey, we also have what does Michal do? How does Michal disguise David's absence? So she takes the statues and she covers them up with some goat hair. So you have the old goat hair, human hair swaparoo from Parshas Toldos. So a number of points again in Parakutas linking Yaakov with David. They have a whole experience. Father-in-law, difficult father-in-law, the cheating father-in-law, the murderous father-in-law, ending also with the son-in-law on the run. And then the third and really most dramatic parak, which links David with Yaakov Avinu, is Parak Chaf Hei in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. What's happening in Parak Chaf Hei is David is in the desert of Midbar Yehuda, and he is trying to make a living by providing security, and he is watching the sheep of Naval, who is a leading, extremely wealthy personality from Shevet Yehuda. After a while, David goes to Naval when Naval is shearing the sheep, and David basically sends some men to ask, can you cut us in on the profits? We've been providing security for months and months, and we've been saving your shepherds a whole lot of trouble, a whole lot of danger out in the field, out in the whatever pastures, I guess, for sheep, right? So can you pay us? And Naval says no. And there are a number of pieces here which recall the relationship between David and Lavan. You have the watching of the sheep. You have Naval's own shepherds who refer to the fact that that David and his men were working in the fields for the sheep at night and during the day, which is exactly the complaint that Yaakov makes about Laban. You have the salary stiffing because Naval says no. Naval says he's not going to pay David, and David is furious about this. This is not fair. Ach l'sheker shamarti kol asher lo zemebar. What, in vain I guarded his stuff, right? Lo nifka mikol asher lo me'uma. He never missed anything. He never missed anything. A single sheep was never lost to Naval. Exactly the same as Yaakov's experience with Laban. I was your shepherd for 20 years. In the day, he says, at night, in the heat, in the cold, you never lost a sheep. If you lost a sheep, I repaid it, Yaakov says. The Navi uses a lot, many, many of the languages that Yaakov uses in his fight against Laban. We have here David facing off against Naval. And the Medrash Tehillim just has the kicker. Again, I'm Rabbi Simon. Who Naval, who Laban? Naval and Laban, same guy. Hein heina osios. They even share the same letters. You know, you swap around the nun, the lamed, the beis, you get the same name. Medrash doesn't mean that they're literally the same person, but they have the exact same personality. Ma Laban haron ramai, af Naval haya ramai. Laban was quintessentially a cheater. Naval is quintessentially a cheater, right? At the same time, we have David who beating us over the head. You think of David, you think of Yaakov, right? The ish tam, yosheva alim, person of innocence, the person is persecuted, the person is being ripped off and abused by his father-in-law. Yaakov only had one father-in-law personality he had to deal with, and David HaMelech has two. He's got Shaul, and he's got Naval. So that Yaakov force, you know, the Yafei Einayim, the Navi certainly comes through time and time again. And that's very good. We understand why that kind of person should be king. You'd hope that somebody who's going to be king, who's going to hold all that corruptive power, is going to have the innocence and the goodness and the sweetness of heart of a Yaakov Avinu, as opposed to, you know, Rahman al-Islam, cruelty and hatred, right? But at the same time, David and Esau. Right. There are, as well, a number of instances, really three, and the third is going to be the most overwhelming, which seem to highlight David's, you won't call it the darker side or the redder side, because it's the Esav side. That's certainly there as well. What was Esav's original flaw? The original flaw Esav has. Before we see him plotting to murder Yaakov, or before we see him out in the wilderness with his hundreds of soldiers doing whatever, who knows what they're doing. It's the original flaw Esav has. It's exposed in that whole story when he sells the birthright to Yaakov. Mefarshim asks, why exactly did Esav sell the birthright? I mean, you know, if being firstborn means you get a double portion, so Esav certainly doesn't mind money, right? We never get the impression that Esav didn't like a nice check. So why is he so dismissive of the birthright? Ibn Ezra has this wild piece where he says, well, actually, Yitzhak was poor, so he lost all his money. So Esav had nothing to lose. He didn't really care. The Ramban takes him to task. The Ramban says, no, you have to understand Esav's personality. Esav's fundamental flaw is that he is somebody of extreme hastiness. He is somebody who lives in the moment. And nowadays, we say live in the moment. In modern society, that's presented as something that's positive, but it's not really. You're not supposed to just live for this split second now. Yeah, we want people to be thinking more maturely, thinking in the long term, thinking, anticipating the future. Someone who's wise, someone who anticipates the future. That is not Esav. Esav figures, I hunt, I live a dangerous life, I live a fun life, I'm going to die young. That's Esav thinks, I'm going to die young. So what do I care about what my investment, my wealth management advisor telling me about the long-term futures of this birthright? I'm never going to be around to see it. I'm going to get killed by some wild animal one of these times that I'm out there hunting. So I'm probably drunk half the time I go. It's not going to end well for me. I don't care because I live in the moment, right? So where I'm standing now, says Esav, what do I care about some bechorah that's going to be relevant in decades and decades? I'm going to be gone. Esav thinks in the short term. And that goes very well with this whole personality, the quickness, the man of action, the man of anger. Esav's always rushing, right? It's never calm. It's never, like a real, slow, careful, strategic, patient planning. He's not a planner, right? It just doesn't go with that whole personality. And this idea of hastiness and just eagerly running into decisions, and that gets you to, that whole personality gets you to anger and gets you to violence, comes up with David a few times. And actually, each time it comes up, it gets worse and worse. The first time it comes up is after David runs away from Shaul, right? After Michal lets him escape. So he runs to Nov, the city of the Kohanim. It's where the Mishkan is. The Kohen Gadol sees him come, and the Kohen Gadol panics, probably because he can sense that something is terribly wrong. Why is the king's son-in-law and the king's chief general coming all by himself, and he's starving? It looks something is seriously wrong. So David tells a lie, and David says, yeah, I'm sent here on some secret mission. And then what does he say? He demands food, right? And you have to even look, the way he demands it, if you think of Esav demanding the lentil soup from Yaakov, you can hear shadows of it. Ata, now he says in Pasuk Dal. What do you got for me? What do you got? Chamisha lechem, you got 5 loaves of bread? Tanabi yadi, give it to me, put it in my hand. Oh hanimta, whatever you got. It's almost like a carjacking, like a bread jacking, right? Give me what you got, give it to me now. I need food. Okay, now the Kohen says to him, you're in a Mishkan, you're not in a bakery, it's not Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, I'm not really sure what you're asking for here. I have the lechem apanim, I have the bread, which is kadosh. Okay, David says, yeah, don't worry, right? Give it, I'll take it. Then the Nabi tells us that who is there watching this happen? There's a man from Shaul's servants, Doeg Ha'adomi. That's interesting. He's doing the Edomite, if that's the correct way to translate that. It's not so clear, but that's a Doeg Ha'adomi, maybe a descendant of Esav, possibly. He's there watching the whole thing. You have a member of Shaul's cabinet who's in the Mishkan watching this. Does that inhibit David from demanding food as he's a fugitive from the Kohen Gadol? No. And then David does something even worse. David says, give me a weapon. Now, if you're a fugitive, I mean, he says, give me, it's not bad enough to give me bread in public. Give me a weapon? And what does the Kohen say to him? Look, you're in a Mishkan. There's only one weapon here. It's the sword of Goliath, which you brought to the Mishkan. And we can imagine the massive symbolism of that sword. But David just says, Inkama tinenali. Not like it, give it to me. So David is demanding, he's taking, give, give me food, give it to me now, give me a weapon, give it to me now. And what he does is insane, because you have Doeg, you have a member of Shaul's government watching the whole thing, and he's watching David take the food in full view, supporting a fugitive. He's watching him take the weapon, and not only any weapon, but the ultimate symbolic weapon if David wants to launch a rebellion against Shaul. It would be the weapon where, hey guys, remember when Shaul was supposed to fight Goliath and he didn't do it, and I did instead, and I won? Hey, I got that sword. That could be the banner for rebellion. And David is not inhibited by that. Just give it to me now. I need it. Whatever happens down the road, happens down the road. Now, what happens down the road? One parak later, Doeg will tell Shaul about this, and Shaul will wipe out the whole city of Nob, right? Which is terrible on David's on Shaul's side. But look at what Chazal say about the episode. The Gemara has a bit of a drasha at a pasuk at the end of Shmuel Beis, but the way the Gemara understands it, I'm going to Kadosh Baruch Hu David. Ad masa ye avon zat tamon biyadecha. How long is this sin going to be hidden in your hand? Al yadcha nerga nov yarkonin. You are responsible for the destruction of the city. Val yadcha nitrad dag doeg hadomi, because you're the one who inspired doeg hadomi to go after Nov. Val yadcha nergu shaul shoshes banav. And the ultimate consequences of your hastiness over here and your demand for bread and your demand for weapons and a mishkan in full view, ultimate consequence of that was it led to the death of Shaul and his three sons. Because Shaul is going to be punished for what he did, but David's hastiness here down the road leads ultimately to catastrophe. Now, the critical point though, and this is going to be true for David the whole way through, right? Because we ask, he has this Yaakov Avinu piece. He has the innocence. He has the victim. He has the goodness. He has the sweetness. He also has the energy, the anger, the rashness, the living in the moment, the short-term thought. How is he able to balance? He's able to balance because unlike Esau, and unlike Shaul, frankly, when he strays, and it's inevitable he's going to stray, every single time David comes back, he's always either able to check himself or he's able to be checked by others. So at the end of the parak, what happens? One fugitive from Nov, the city of Kohanim, comes running to David. His name is Ebyasar. And what does David tell him? He says, I know, Yadati Bayomahu, Hisham Doeg Ha'adomi. I knew when I saw Doeg, he haged Yagil the Shaul. I knew that he was going to tell Shaul. Anochi sabosi b'chol nefesh beis avicha. I am responsible for the death of your family. Nobody made David do this at all. It will be the easiest thing in the world for David, who is an innocent fugitive of Shaul, to turn to this Avyasar and say, hey, we have the same experience. Shaul is after me for no reason. He's after you for no reason. We're on the same side. We're both victims of Shaul. Instead, what does he say? It's not that we're both Shaul's victims. You are my victim. I messed up. And it's not just words, but he puts his money where his mouth is. And he says, I will take it upon my responsibility to protect you going forward. Shvayti alti ras, stay with me, do not fear. We're on the same team. I am going to protect you. So it's the first instance where David totally messes up. He acts extremely rashly, extremely short-sightedly. But he realizes that. He apologizes for that. He recognizes he did wrong, and he takes corrective action. And that's going to happen every single time. Happens again a couple of prakim later, the episode in Shaul's cave, right? Think of an episode in Shaul's cave, and it's amazing. Shaul is there. David has the chance to kill him, and he doesn't do it, right? The willpower that David had. Rabag points out, though, you take a careful look in the psukim, and it's not so simple. What happens? Pasuk Dalet, they're in Parakhat Dalet. David's men tell him, look, there's Shaul alone going to the bathroom. It's amazing. We're surrounded by Shaul's men. They're 3,000. We're 600. We thought we were doomed. We thought we were about to die. Coincidence of coincidences, Shaul decides to go by himself, to go to the relief himself in the cave. He happens to choose our cave. This is our chance. We can save our lives and you can be king. And this is not a coincidence, David's men tell him. Hine hayom asher amar Hashem elecha. Hashem brought this about. Hine anochi noseinas ayvacha biyadecha. Hashem told you he was going to put your enemies in your hand. Right? Just like Shaul said, oh, Baruch Hashem, God put David in my hand. So now David's men are telling him the exact same thing. Except in this case, it's awfully convincing. What kind of man of faith is going to say it's a coincidence that Shaul happened to walk alone into our cave? David does not laugh them off. He does not reject them. Pasuk says, Navi says it's a little bit strange. Zava gets up. And he cuts off the edge of Shaul's robe, right? It's in secret. It's in the dark, pitch black in that cave. Anyone's ever been to Ein Gedi, you know what that looks like in those caves. In other words, David's heart beat against him. Because he cut off the piece of the garment. So what exactly is going on? The Ralbag explains that initially, David was swayed by his men. David gets so wrapped up, he gets so excited in the moment. The men are all excited. David's all excited. Shaul's here. We have the chance. It's pitch black. He takes his knife and he makes a swing for Shaul. And he misses. Mr. Shaul's pitch black in there. What does he get instead? He gets a piece of Shaul's robe. And it is at that moment, after he messed up, right? He messed up. He tried to kill Shaul. He got a piece of the robe. Then David's inner instinct responds, right? The tshuva instinct comes back. David, what are you doing? This is Hashem's anointed. You have to back off. You have to stand down. Right? Rabbah says, he tried to kill him, but it didn't work. He just got the knap. He got the garment. And then David has his regret. Right? So you have the same instance. The short term, violence, action, do it, kill him, swings the sword. But he's able to correct. Right? He's able to get himself back on the path. In the case where the comparison to Esav is the most obvious, right? If you just had these two, it'd say, okay, you know, they share a property of some hastiness and rashness and inclination to action. And, okay, so they're the only two people who we see, demanding food on the spot. But is that really enough to convince us that we're supposed to think of Esau when we think of David HaMelech? Maybe not. But you get to the third story, and now it's going to be clear. Because what happens? In the aftermath of the David Naval episode, Naval has just ripped David off. Right? You watched my sheep for months and months in the day, at night, in the heat, and the cold. I'm not giving you a red cent, Naval says. Right? So we had Naval filling the Lavan role, David filling the Yaakov role, very, very clearly. And all of a sudden, what's David's reaction to Parakit Yamal? V'yamar David l'anashav. David says to his men, boys, Chigru ish escharba. Each man gird your sword. They all put on their swords. Chigru ish escharbo. Bayach gor gam David escharbo. David is going to lead them into battle because he's a real leader. He's not going to send his men and lead from the rear. He's going to be at the front. Bayalu achare David ka'arba meos ish. David goes at the head of 400 men to wipe out Naval. Now, okay, we've seen this story before. When's the last time we've seen 400 people with one red-headed, red-faced person at their head to go wipe someone out? It's Esau. And then confirming it, what happens on the other side? Naval's wife, Abigail, to head David off, and we could go through the psukim in detail, but just to get the general piece. So Abigail tries to head him off by sending him a present, which she will call a bracha, right? There's bread, wine, and some sheep, some other food. And she sends the gift ahead to David and his 400 men. Then she comes after the gift. Her servants bring the gift. She comes in the rear. She bows down. She speaks very, very submissively. She calls David an Adon. She calls herself his maidservant. It's exactly the Yaakov playbook, word for word. Send the gift, send more gifts, send more gifts, then come from behind, then Yaakov's going to bow down to Esav, then Yaakov is going to speak very submissively to Esav. You have a total reversal, right? In the beginning of the parak, Naval was Lavan, and David was Yaakov, but now it transforms, and David puts on his sword and leads his 400 men raging into battle. he has transformed into Esav, who's going to wipe out a whole household. And the other side, right, you have Abigail, who's fulfilling the role of Yaakov. Right. It's you see right there. You see right there the corruptive power of leadership. Right. He's got his men. He's got his army. He's not using it for good over here. He's using it to wipe out a whole household. But once again, David is able to be moved. When Abigail gets there, Abigail finishes her speech. He recognizes Hashem. He takes a step back. He calms down. He takes a step out of himself. He realizes, you've saved me from murder. Chai Hashem, Hashem Ananimir Meharo Sach. Thank God for sending you to me. It's another thing that Yaakov and David share in common, by the way, is Hashkacha, right? Providence all the way through. With Yaakov from Parshas Vayetze in the latter, all the way to Hamalach and Goel, and David as well. And David recognized himself. Lulemi Hart, Batavoslik Rasi, Kim Nosla Navalad or Boker Mishtin Bakir. If you had not headed me off, I know myself, says David, and I would have wiped out the entire, there would not have been a single man left in the whole family. I would have wiped them all out, right? Now, happens to be, some side, you know, you can file this away, you can talk about this next week. This this piece with David and Abigail, right, and the parallel to Esav and to Yaakov, explains a Rashi that everybody knows, but nobody really understands. Right, it was Rashi in Parshas Vayishlah. So Yaakov approaches Esav, and he approaches Esav with his 11 children. Esachar Asar Yelada. Right, he's got 11 kids. Problem is, Rashi flags what's bothering Rashi. Yaakov does not have 11 kids. He has 11 sons because Rachel is pregnant with Binyamin. But he's got 12 kids, right? Because what about Dina? Now, Dina's certainly in the picture. So this is where Rashi says, right? Where is Dina? Yaakov put Dina in the box because he didn't want Esav to see Dina. All right, Rashi says that Yaakov was punished because he prevented Esav from marrying Dina. Shema tachsirena lemutav. Maybe Dina would have been able to turn Esav around. All right, it's like, where do we get that from? Right? What evidence have we ever had that Esav would be somebody who could be turned around? But the answer is that all the Medrash is doing is saying, look at what Abigail was able to do to David. And you just have to plug in, you know, Yaakov's daughter, Dina, and Esav, and you could have had the exact same result. Because at the end of the parak, David is going to marry Abigail. One thing David totally realizes is, since he has a nature which is apt to make mistakes initially, he needs to surround himself with people who can correct him and who he will listen to. It happened again and again, from his generals, to his Nevi'im, his wife, his wives. The truth is, right, and that's how David is able to keep that Esav element in check. And Rashi is just saying that Yaakov could have had faith in his brother, that his own daughter could have done the same thing, right? How could you blend the power of Yaakov and blend the power of Esav, which was always the dream that Yitzchak Avinu had had? You could have married Yaakov's daughter to Esav. Now we understand why Yaakov didn't want to do that, but that was the potential, that was the decision that was made, right? Really, in sum, the way that we can think of David is exactly how Yitzchak describes Yaakov when he comes to get the bracha. Yitzchak says, "Akol kol Yaakov, hayadayim b'day Esav." Right? It's Yaakov's voice, but it's David's hand, but it's Esav's hands, and that's exactly David, isn't it? David is the one who's the author of Tehillim. He's also the leading conqueror in Jewish history. You know, David fights two main battles in the beginning of his career against the Plishtim. We know about the one with Goliath and the Goliath battle. So David is totally in the mode of Kol Yaakov. He does not come with a single weapon, no sword, no armor. And he says to Goliath, you come with me with weapons. I come with Hashem, Elokei Tzivakos, Elokei Marachos Yisrael, Asher Chayravta. I don't fight the battle. Hashem fights the battle. Hashem gives you to me. Hakol kol Yaakov, right? We can defeat our enemies through tefillah. We can defeat our enemies through bitachon. It doesn't really matter what military power we bring to bear. All we need is to have Hashem on our side. Hakol kol Yaakov. And yet, what do we see one parak later? Not as focused on, but one parak later, when David is promoted to general, so Yehonasan takes off his armor. He gives David his armor. He gives David his sword. He gives David his bow. David is all geared out for battle. And David goes as the Jazz Shaul's general. All of a sudden, you have Yadayim Yidei Esa. You have the fighter. You have the warrior, right? But David is able to combine both. He's able to combine both. Are there going to be mistakes along the way? Yes. But the key is going to be for him to channel it in the right direction. And when it begins to go off course, the tshuva piece, he knows his flaws, he is self-aware. Oh yeah, no, that was a mistake demanding food when Doug was there. I should have done better than that. He's not going to deny it. He's going to react and change course, right? And the last piece, and really where this all comes from, is that, and here David is so different from Shaul, is that David, and as somebody who knows his flaws, David is able to realize that his will is not perfect and his will is not the only thing to follow. And again and again and again, he realizes that Hashem's will is over his. As Chazal had said in the Medrash, that Hashem said to Shmuel, yes, you see he has a tendency to kill, but he's gonna channel that to what the Sanhedrin says and not to what he wants to do. We have that again and again and again. You have that in the cave where, right, he wants to kill Shaul, and then he holds back and he says, God forbid I should do something. Right? Even though his men are saying, Hashem desires you to kill Shaul. You have it a couple of prakim later when Shaul is asleep and he goes with his nephew Avishai, and Avishai says, this is amazing. Shaul is lying asleep on the ground. You can kill him. Sigar elokim ayom es ayva chabiyadecha. Hashem put Shaul in your hands. Be frum. Take the frum choice and kill Shaul. And David says, no way, right? That's not the frum choice. You're dressing up an Avera in holy clothing, right? I can recognize what is something that I might want to do and what Hashem actually wants. Shaul in this situation would have said exactly what Avishai says, right? God gave me this opportunity. And David says, no, I can realize when it's what I'm convincing myself is the Ratzon Abore and when it is actually what Hashem wants. I'm not going to fall into that trap. Happens again and again and again. Just a couple of examples. In Parachaf Beis, David is on the run. He finally finds a place of security in a mitzudah by near Moab. One pasuk later, God the Navi tells David, don't stay here. Is it safe? Is it secure? Yes. But don't stay in Moab. Go back to the land of Yehuda. And David says, no problem, right? Is it militarily risky? Is it going to lead to a tougher life where instead of having a nice, secure location, he's going to be on the run in the desert? Yes. But does David do it unhesitatingly? Absolutely. This comes up again and again and again. Towards the end of Parakraf Shmuel Aleph, when David fights Amalek. So, you know, his men are furious because he's caused all their family to be captured. David's response, right? He just says, look, I'm going to do what Hashem tells me. I'm just going to do what Hashem tells me. Comes up again and again and again. And, you know, more to say, but let's conclude with one last point. We think about David and Yaakov and Esav and Shaul. The bracha that is ultimately given to Yaakov is that his name changes to Yisrael, right? What does it mean? Yaakov, lo Yaakov, yamero shimcha, kim Yisrael, ki sarisa im elokim ve'iman Hashem batucha. But Yaakov is able to fight and is able to defeat people who are far more powerful than he is. And it's that real exact bracha which is given to David as well. David is the one who is going to sarisa im elokim ve'iman Hashem batucha. Is he going to take on Shaul, who's far more powerful? Yes. Is he going to win? Yes. Is he going to win because of his military prowess? No, he's going to win because he has Hashem behind him and he understands that, right? Just like Yaakov realizes it's not his own power which will help him defeat the Malach, but he defeats him anyway. Same thing with David HaMelech. He's going to fight against the Plishtim. He's going to fight against all his enemies all around. He's going to fight a Malek when they're much more powerful than he is, consistently, time and time again. It's the Yerushalayim, and it's the Bitachon that David has, combined with the energy and the charisma, right? He has this amazingly magnetic personality and power that he leads, that gets people to just feel like David's going to be their leader. And if people who want to kill David 1 minute because they think they blame him for having led all their families into captivity, and a few psukim later, they're going to be singing his praises. Sarisa emelokim v'anashim v'atzmucha. And it all stems, right? It all comes back to the recognition that being a king is a job for a flawed person, but it has to be somebody who has the right flaws, someone who recognizes those flaws, and someone who puts the systems in place to keep those under control in general and to correct them when they get out of control. And that is exactly what David HaMelech is able to do time and time again. Okay, so with that, a little bit over time this week, so I apologize. We'll stop here. Chris Chen, we're going to take a break for a little bit, and then in a week or two, we're going to come back, if people are interested, and we'll go through Sefer Shmuel Beis, and we can really learn, you know, the Sefer of David's kingship in depth, and we'll see, now that we have the basic tools, the basic perspectives of David, we'll go story by story and see how he rises to challenge after challenge, and how so much of that is so relevant and so inspirational to all of us. So, Shkach, everyone, thanks for coming. Have a wonderful rest of the week.